Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of True Story on the Authors on the Air Network. I'm your host, Brian Freeman, and I'm the author of 15 best-selling psychological thrillers, including my latest Alter Ego, which is available right now from Quercus Hachette. What we do on this show is introduce you to nonfiction authors with great stories to tell, and today we are talking about one of the most famous true-life mysteries of all time. Did you grow up hearing stories about the lost colony of Roanoke? I know I did. And I want you to go back and try to imagine what it was like in the wilderness of the New World in 1587. That's less than 100 years after Columbus and nearly 200 years before the Revolutionary War, 1587. More than four centuries ago, over 100 men and women arrived on the beach at Roanoke Island and tried to mount the first permanent English settlement in America. Only weeks later, before winter set in, the colony's leader, John White, left the settlers behind, including his daughter and his new granddaughter, who was born on the island, to sail home for more supplies. He was supposed to be gone 6 months. It took him 3 years to make it back. And when he finally returned, the colonists had all vanished. And the only clue to their fate was a single word, Croatoan, carved into a tree. What really happened to the lost colony? Where did they go? Did any of them survive? It's a story that has obsessed archaeologists, historians, and mystery lovers ever since. But to this day, we've had no real answers to any of the questions. Well, will we ever know the truth about Roanoke? Well, today we have Andrew Lawler with us, and he is the author of the new book, The Secret Token: Myth, Obsession, and the Search for the Lost Colony of Roanoke. It's a beautifully written book. It's a fascinating look at how the Roanoke colony came to be and at all the conflicting theories, strange evidence, and out-and-out hoaxes that have teased us for centuries about the colony's fate. Andrew, welcome to True Story.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, why don't you tell us, first of all, a little bit about the background of the Roanoke colony and why this colony even came to be back then?
Sure. Well, if you dial back to the 1580s, so we're talking about a couple of decades before Jamestown, the first permanent settlement by the English, it's Elizabethan England. Queen Elizabeth I is on the throne. England is actually a pretty small and poor and relatively backward country. Spain is the place to go. Spain is incredibly wealthy. It controls most of the New World. It has a massive empire spread around the world. And the English looked around and realized they wanted to get some of what Spain had. So Sir Walter Raleigh, who was one of Queen Elizabeth's favored courtiers, decided that he would pull together the financing and the expertise he needed to send a group of people to the New World and to stake a claim for England there. So he sent a reconnaissance mission in 1584. They came back and said, hey, we found this beautiful place that has lots of promise. And so they sent us a second group over with 100 men to try and settle what was, what we call now, the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And that group got chased away by the Native Americans after less than a year. And so the third and final group that went was what we call the Lost Colony. And there were 115 men, women, and children that left England and arrived in the New World on Roanoke and tried to build a new life. And that's where the story ends.
And Roanoke wasn't even supposed to be the location for the colony, was it?
No. In fact, the third colony, that is the Lost Colony, was supposed to go up to the Chesapeake Bay. Now, this made a lot of sense, and in fact, 20 years later, the Jamestown settlers decided that the lower Chesapeake Bay, where they settled, was a good place to be. Deeper harbors, friendlier Native Americans seemed like a good place to go. The Outer Banks, by contrast, was a dangerous place. It's still a place that's called the Graveyard of the Atlantic. It's probably been responsible for more shipwreck deaths than any other place in the country. Shallow water, not a lot of ground to plant on. It's really not an ideal place to settle as a group. So why did they go there? Well, that's one of the mysteries within the mystery of the Lost Colony. They were supposed to go to the Chesapeake Bay, but the navigator dropped them off at Roanoke and refused to take them north. Now, exactly why that happened is something I explore in the book, and I think the conventional wisdom is probably pretty wrong.
Well, and who, tell us a little bit about who these people were. I mean, most of them weren't explorers or adventurers. I mean, why make a journey like this? What was the makeup of the people that were going on this exploration?
Well, this is a great question, and until fairly recently, we had no answers to it. We only had a list of the people who went. But to try and identify who a George Smith is in England in the 1580s is very hard because a lot of people had the same name. So,
sure.
You know, who are we talking about? But there was a scholar named William Powell who, since just deceased recently, who went to England and he spent decades sorting through all of the archives, going to churches and parish records. And what he discovered was really interesting. So the conventional wisdom was that the lost colonists were probably farmers who wanted to go to the New World to farm and find new land and be able to create a larger, prosperous estate. But actually, what Powell found was not like that at all. He discovered that most of the colonists seemed to have been middle-class merchants from London. These were city people. Most of them were from the city of London, which then was one of the largest cities in Europe. And most of them were shopkeepers and lawyers and others who wanted to make a new start, get away from a place that, even though Shakespeare was just arriving in London in that day, most people wanted to escape because it was full of plague. There were lots of poor people moving in. It was not a very pleasant place to live if you didn't have a lot of money. So these colonists clearly decided they would take their chance to go to the New World, and they would get land, they would be able to start a new life and create what was basically a little small English village that they hoped would grow into something larger and more prosperous.
You know, I think back to what the physical challenges must have been like at that point. I mean, and then you add in sort of the additional geopolitical challenges. I mean, clearly you've already got this extraordinary situation in terms of the wilderness, food, shelter, weather. But then, as you mentioned, you already had the Spanish that were staking claims further south. They didn't want the English in the New World. And relations with the native population were already turning violent and had gone wrong. It's really extraordinary to me to just think about these people sort of willing to take their chances on this sort of barren rock in the middle of the wilderness.
Well, the truth is that this was not wilderness. I mean, this is one of the ideas that we've been fed as a country that actually turns out not to be true. When the English arrived on the coast of North Carolina, there were thousands and thousands of Algonquin-speaking natives who had been there for centuries. And they had towns, they had villages, they had fields, they were growing things, they knew how to fish and hunt. They were extremely well adapted to that environment. They knew how to not just survive, but thrive. And we have accounts from the English of large villages along the rivers and how people would feast, and they were saving food for the next year. They had surpluses. So when the English arrived, it was actually the English who were the ones who were incapable of taking care of themselves. They constantly were trying to trade their goods in order to get food from the Indians because they didn't know how to grow it themselves. They had trouble fishing, which is hard to believe, but true. They had trouble even gathering shellfish. And if you've ever been to the coast of North Carolina, you know it must have been hard to starve, yet somehow the English managed to really be incapable of living there without Native American help.
Right, right. You know, I think back, you talk a lot about the individuals that were part of the expedition, and it, you know, when you go back to that time, there were so few actual people involved in so many of these journeys that the particular individuals kind of end up having an outsized impact on the development of relations and history. Do you think there was ever a point at which the relations between the incoming settlers and the native populations could have gone differently than it did? Or do you think it was, that it was inevitable that there would be conflict?
Well, you know, this is an important question. And it's important because Roanoke is our creation story. It was the first attempt by the English to settle in the New World. So what happened on Roanoke is really critical to understanding how we created what you could say is our national DNA. So I think one of the important questions is, you know, did things have to go the way they went with the English and the Native Americans? Did what happened after that was so violent and so terrible, was it inevitable? And I think the answer that we get from Roanoke is no. There was violence between the English and the Native Americans when they first, in those first years. But in the beginning, the relationship was actually quite good because the Indians had what the English wanted. They had knowledge of the area. They knew how to survive and thrive. They knew how to get the resources. They knew where the resources were. Now, on the other side, the Indians were very interested in the technology that the English brought, particularly metal, because there was some copper, but not much. But the English arrived with weapons that and practical tools like hoes, swords, knives that could be used, you know, every day by the Indians. So immediately there was kind of an agreement that you have what we want and we have what you want. Let's trade peacefully and let's see if we can live together. And there really was a concerted effort by many of the English and the Native Americans to try and live together. And so I don't think it was inevitable what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think probably the most curious figure for me in your book is John White. I mean, he's the head of the colony. He leaves his daughter and his granddaughter behind in this wilderness. His return is delayed for an infuriating 3 years. And yet when he finally makes it back, he seems to make barely a cursory search before setting sail for home again, and he never returns. How do you explain this man?
This is the heart of the mystery. So just a little background. John White was the artist in the first settlers who arrived, who then returned to England. He did these masterful drawings of Native Americans, which are some of the best images that we have of the Indians of that period. And then Walter Raleigh appointed him governor of what became known as the Lost Colony, which was an odd choice because he wasn't a manager. Clearly, he was an artist who didn't have a lot of skills when it came to the military, for example, or governing. But he was put in charge, and it's not clear, but there are hints that people were not happy with his leadership. In fact, there's even suggestion that the colonists kind of said, John, you know, why don't you go back to England and bring back some supplies for us? You know, like, kind of, you know, like, let's get this guy out of the way. Now, we don't know that for sure, but they clearly didn't mourn the fact that he was leaving. So when he left, you know, that was it. 3 years passed before he could return. I mean, this guy underwent such terrible, terrible vicissitudes that make Job looked like he had an easy time. You know, he kept trying to get back to the New World, and every time there were pirates, there were storms, there was war with Spain. I mean, you name it. It's like the universe conspired to prevent John White from returning with supplies to the colonists and his own daughter and granddaughter who were there.
Right.
When he finally arrives in 1590, in fact, on the very third birthday of his granddaughter, Virginia Dare, he found nothing except, as you mentioned in the intro, this carving on a post that said Croatoan. But after searching around for a while, not seeing anybody, a storm came up. They got back on the ship, and then the storm got worse. And eventually, because they lost an anchor, they had to sail away. They couldn't sail to Croatoan, which was only 50 miles away. So it's a real mystery because you would have thought he would have said, let's stay and look around and see if we gather more clues. But he didn't. And the trouble is, the only written account we have of this 1590 search and rescue mission comes from the hand of John White. So it's quite possible he was trying to maybe cast blame on others, or we don't even know if he was telling the truth in this account. We assume it's true, but we don't know. And so this adds to the mystery of, you know, who was this man who was so key to understanding what happened? And imagine psychologically, you know, he's responsible for these people and they vanished. And that must have been, you know, a terrible thing to know, and particularly given that you've left your own family there.
Right, right, right. Well, you mentioned White's granddaughter, Virginia Dare, and the first English baby born in the New World. And it seems to me that this little girl is sort of one of the reasons that the Roanoke mystery has always been so compelling. I mean, it's not just adults. It's this kind of the symbol of this little child born into the wilderness, and we want to know what happened to her. I mean, do you think the mystery of the Lost Colony would have the same draw for people if there were no Virginia Dare?
Well, this was one of my biggest surprises when I was on this journey. And that was that the Lost Colony wasn't always lost. It wasn't until the 19th century that people began to talk about the Lost Colony. Before then, it was just, oh, those Elizabethans who vanished and who failed and, you know, they didn't really do anything and they're not worth remembering. But suddenly in the 19th century, it became this romantic story with an aura of mystery. And at the center of this mystery was this child who was born of Eleanor and Ananias Dare, Eleanor Dare being John White's daughter. And all we know about her is when she was born and that she was baptized. That's it, because then John White left. So you have to say that she's the most famous American about whom we know so little. And yet in the 19th century, she became this incredible figure. Now, in part because we know so little about her, she's like a giant projection screen.
Yeah,
and
blank
people
slate.
Imagined. Yeah, exactly. People imagined that she grew up in the woods. She became kind of a huntress. She had blonde hair and blue eyes, and the Indians were so impressed with her hunting skills. She remained virginal. You know, it's this whole series of very, very popular legends grew up in the 19th century. And I thought, you know, why? Why then? And when I started to dig into what was happening during the period, it became very clear that Virginia Dare was a symbol of more than the Lost Colony. That she was a symbol for Americans, particularly white Americans, particularly those who originally came from England, who were very fearful of a time when the country was changing. The time when German Catholics and Irish Catholics were coming into the country, Native Americans were being shipped west, there were slave rebellions, Nat Turner's Rebellion in Virginia, and this is all happening right in those years where this story, the Lost Colony and Virginia Dare, began to surface. And I suddenly realized that the colonists have a lot more to say about who we are than we necessarily have to say about them.
One of the parts of the book that I really loved was the way you kind of talk about Lost Colony syndrome and this obsession to solve the mystery of Roanoke. It seems like it just swallows up scientists and ordinary people over the years. I love the period you describe in the late 30s when a lot of Roanoke hoaxes begin to appear. FDR highlights the 350th birthday of Virginia Dare, and suddenly all these miraculous stones from the from carvings from the Roanoke period begin to appear, and this one man seems to just kind of keep finding them day after day after day. And what was amazing to me was sort of the need to believe that people had, and that even, you know, scientists were sort of willing to kind of give themselves over to things that seemed like pretty transparent fakes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that shows the power, the emotional power that the story of Roanoke has. And I wonder, it's like, what is this emotional power? I mean, obviously it's a mystery, but, you know, I think it goes back to this idea that it's our founding myth. I mean, it helps explain who we are and how we got to be the way we are. So it became something that people would spin stories about to kind of explain how they saw the times. And of course, then you had people who wanted to trade on that interest by creating fake stones, which told the story of how Eleanor Dare was trapped and captured by the Indians and her husband was killed. Now, almost all of those stones were discredited. In fact, all of them were except one, the first
except
stone
one.
That was found, except one. And that stone, it was not associated with the guy you mentioned who was creating these stones and basically pawning them off on a poor Georgia historian who fell for it. But there's one stone that remains mysterious, and it hasn't been properly analyzed scientifically. And back in the 30s, it was declared to be real, and then an investigative journalist did a report And he assumed it was fake because the others were fake, because he found that the person who had made the others was clearly creating a hoax. But I think this one stone deserves to be analyzed scientifically so that we can answer once and for all whether or not the incredible story that it tells, which is of a massacre that kills both Virginia Dare and her father, whether this is true. We may have had the answer to what happened to the lost colonists all along, staring us in the face, or it may be a really, really good hoax. And I would like to find out.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the magical timing of discovering the Dare Stone, you know, kind of gives it the earmarks of a hoax. And yet the experts you talked to weren't sure. And they still had debate about that.
Well, I was sure that it was fake. And I thought, well, you know, I need to do my due diligence. I'm a reporter. I write about archaeology and science. So I went to the experts and I showed them high definition, high resolution images that our National Geographic photographer had taken. And I expect them to say, wow, this is really bad. I mean, this is obviously fake. But to my surprise, 4 out of the 5 experts said, oh, this is totally plausible. And I was blown away by that. So right now the stone, which is just north of Atlanta in a small college called Bernal, they're preparing to do a series of scientific tests which could tell us whether or not it's fake. I don't know for sure, but you'll see in the book that I pull together, you know, a good deal of kind of interesting evidence that makes it clear it's not the simple hoax that people thought it is.
Right, exactly. Now, I'm not sure this is really a spoiler, but some of the mystery lovers out there may want to plug their ears. You don't really think the lost colony was ever lost, do you? What do you think happened to them?
I think you're right. I think the lost colony was not lost. The lost colony was only lost to those Europeans who lost sight of them. But that doesn't mean they went away. In fact, I was talking to one of the people who works as a pirate at Roanoke Island Festival Park on Roanoke Island. He works on a ship there. And he says, well, I tell people that this was the first English settlement in the New World. And I said, but not the first permanent settlement. And he said, I don't know what's more permanent than 115 men, women, and children arriving here and not going back home.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of brought me up short because I realized, well, there's truth in that. And most historians today do think that the obvious thing that happened was that the settlers did not choose to starve. That would be rather foolish. They probably didn't choose to get in a boat and sail back to England. It's possible, but that would have been very, very dangerous given that they didn't have a large ship. And so what are we left with? Well, yes, there might have been a massacre. There might have been there's a terrible drought, we now know. Lots of things could have gone wrong. But we know from later years, from Jamestown and later, that when Europeans were hungry and when things went bad, they went to where the food was. They went to the Native Americans, and they became Native American. That was actually quite common in the 18th and 19th, even the early 19th century. And so if you look at what happened after, you can then focus on Roanoke and say, well, what would you do if you're trapped on an island, you're hungry, you don't know if, you know, your family is going to be able to survive, you don't know if John White's coming back, then I think it's pretty clear that they would turn to their Indian allies in order to be able to survive. And most whites who deserted or were captured and taken into Native American society almost always refused to come back. Benjamin Franklin himself noted that. He said, it's an odd thing that when one of us goes to join the Indians, they stay, but the reverse is not true.
The book is The Secret Token by Andrew Lawler. If any of you listeners out there have even a mild case of Roanoke Obsession Syndrome, well, this is a book you simply cannot miss. We've only touched today on a few little bits from the sweeping epic nature of this story, and it has so many fascinating characters in it, from past and from present. It is, in many ways, I found it to be not only a great history book, it's also an irresistible mystery story, too. Andrew, if people want to learn more about you and your book, where can they go?
Well, they can visit www.andrewlawler.com, And the book will be on sale as of tomorrow. Tomorrow is our launch. So they can visit my website, go on Amazon, go to your independent bookstore. And beware, though, because there is obsession that can follow.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining me on the show tonight.
Thanks very much, Brian. I've enjoyed it.
This is Brian Freeman, and you've been listening to True Story on the Authors on the Air Network. This show is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Now, I know you never want to miss an episode of True Story, so go ahead and go out to Facebook right now and like my show page, which is at facebook.com/True Story Radio. That's facebook.com/True Story Radio, and you'll find links to listen to all of my shows out there. Coming up next week on True Story, we will have a real treat. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Eileen McNamara will be here talking about her new book, Eunice, which is an absolutely fascinating biography of Eunice Kennedy. That will be available for listening next Monday evening, June 11th. And if you want to find out more about my thrillers, and I know you do, then go to my website at bfreemanbooks.com. That's one word, bfreemanbooks.com. I've got two new books out this year, The Voice Inside, which is the follow-up to The Nightbird, one of the top 20 Kindle bestsellers of 2017, and my latest novel, Alter Ego, which is available right now. Thanks for listening, everybody, and happy reading.